Dr. Maple Go, and welcome to Dr. Not Otherwise Specified, also known as Dr. NOS. This podcast is to provide guidance for our junior doctors to navigate medical and non-medical careers. I hope all the doctors out there can get something out of this, whether they're specified or not. Kia pai tora.
Hi to another episode of Dr. NOS. Today we have Dr. Maria Poynter. Maria is a public health medicine specialist and medical officer of health. She's currently the clinical director for the Auckland Regional Public Health Service, but will be the director of transformation in the National Public Health Service. She has previously been a council member for the New Zealand College of Public Health Medicine and is passionate about equity and health-enabling system design. Outside of work, she is energized by family, cooking and exercising in nature. Thank you very much for joining me today, Maria. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Nice to see you.
It's a pleasure to have you. I would love to hear your journey from the beginning, how you found medicine in the first place.
Wow, my kids are asking me that at the moment because they're a similar age to what I was when I first started thinking about medicine. So medicine first popped into my head when I was probably 11 or 12, which is really early. And it was purely because someone in my class at school decided that she wanted to be a doctor. And I thought that sounded quite fun. Didn't know much about it at that point, but I guess my mum had trained as a nurse. So there was always a little bit of health awareness there. And it just never really went away. So I ended up choosing school subjects that allowed me to have a better chance of getting into med school. And it just evolved from there. Yeah. I think at that, the very first thing that I remember about that being quite a cool option was wearing a white coat, ironically, because I don't think I've ever worn a white coat in my life.
So this was early in med school when you were wearing a white coat. Is this for labs or is this?
Oh, no. When I first wanted to be a doctor, like at 11 or 12, it was like, oh, you get to wear a white coat. And I've only worn one for labs at med school. Never in a hospital.
Never again. That's really cool. And then when you got into med school, was it everything you expected it to be and getting out and being a house officer and registrar? Was it what you thought it would be?
I think it wasn't. I expected, I guess, the long hours, that lots of interaction with different people. I didn't expect not to like hospitals. I don't know whether I actually thought about whether I'd like hospitals or not, but I never really liked hospitals. Even going back to first runs as a fourth year, fifth year student, it was never for me. Yeah.
That's fair enough.
And I think the frustration that sent me down the line of public health medicine happened earlier on than I think I had probably realized it would. So I thought I'd be, I presumed I'd be doing what most people think of when they think of a doctor and kind of interacting with individual patients, which was not the life for me.
What was it in fourth and fifth year that switched you away? What was it that made you go down the pathway of public health by then?
So fourth and fifth year, I didn't know that I wanted to do public health. I didn't really think about that until my second year as a health surgeon. In fourth and fifth year, I didn't like the feel on the ward. So I felt very out of place as a student. And I remember that feeling of not knowing where anything was, not feeling like you belong, feeling that you're taking up space and just generally being a pain and not enjoying that. And also the culture then was different to what I understand it tends to be now in hospitals in particular. And it was hard. I was shouted at in surgery because I put dressings on the wrong way and just things that don't make you feel like it's the best place to be.
And what made you start entertaining public health as a pathway and as a specialty when you were in second year? Was there a catalyst in second year?
Yeah, a bit of a long story. So because I didn't like hospitals, I thought that I'd go down a general practice line. And so I'd line myself up some like a peds run and a rural GP run for my third year out. And then during my second year as a health officer, I was working in an emergency department, which is part of that thing of getting wider experience before going down a primary care route. And it was in the days before capitation was really a thing, so it was quite expensive to go to a GP if you needed to see a GP about something. And so I was getting regular patients coming through the emergency department with the same problems. And it was frustrating knowing that I was just a Band-Aid solution for that day and not able to provide any real solution to their problem. And I remember one patient in particular came back several times with chronic back pain, which wasn't biomechanical. It was related to alcoholism and a bunch of other kind of social factors and problems for that person. And I just knew that I was not able to influence the change for that person that I wanted, but also that was the same for many other people that I was seeing. And so the system design aspects really came into play for me. And I love that. I love the really complex system stuff. And by that stage, I'd had enough awareness about public health to know that it was a training pathway option. Mm. And I pretty much, I don't remember the exact moment where I thought I'm going to do public health, but it was a relatively quick switch in my head.
Yeah, that's fair. And from the second year as your house officer and then going into specialist training and the College of Public Health Medicine, what were the steps that you took to start training?
So what I do remember about that time when I made the decision was that I just missed the cutoff for the interviews for the following year. I was very annoyed with myself about that. But so that must have been kind of August, September or so that I decided that, and then knowing that I'd found my specialty, I really didn't want to delay it. And so I actually decided to pull out of the peds and rural GP runs that I'd set up starting the next year and just enroll in the Masters of Public Health full time. So paying my own way. Having just paid off my student loan, I got another student loan to be a full time student again, which was quite a big deal because it meant going back to not having an income and the uncertainty of knowing that I wasn't actually on the training program at that point. But as it turns out, they had an extra intake. And so I only had that first semester, so like February to June, without being a registrar. And then I was able to join the training program and have those first few papers accredited. And while I was doing that first semester, I was kind of a proxy registrar, really, in that many of my peers in the papers were public health registrars. And so I was involved in the same conversations and that sort of thing. We were all having them together.
Mm-mm. For listeners who aren't aware, the Master of Public Health is actually part of the training program for the New Zealand Public Health College of Medicine. So a lot of people may do the MPH beforehand, or they might do the MPH as part of the training. But Maria, I'd love to hear your experiences in terms of how you found training and what's involved in training before you become a SMO in public health.
Yeah, sure. Public health is generally a four-year training program. In New Zealand, it's the public health medicine training program, so you have to be a doctor to qualify. In a couple of other countries, notably the UK, you can become a public health specialist without necessarily having been a doctor first. So it's a sort of a different training, well, same training program, but different entry pathway. So in the New Zealand context, you apply and there's an interview process to get on just as per all the other training programs, pretty much. Yeah, then you do your Master's of Public Health, which is usually a two-year degree, is compressed into 16 months. So if you assume you're a full-time registrar, then you start February first semester, do first and second semester, then do your dissertation pretty much over the summer hiatus or some university holiday period, and then go back and do your third semester of papers and finish your dissertation at that point. So it's quite full on, and that you're compressing it into a tighter time frame. I loved it. I found it was such a privilege learning stuff that I really wanted to be learning. And I think most people that do public health and really enjoy the masters, but also find it quite isolating because a lot of the time you're at home, although that, you know, maybe people have got a bit more experience with that now after COVID. And the other thing that was quite tough is that having done med school, I think many people go into it thinking it's going to be a bit of a breeze because it's not a restricted entry course like medicine is, but it's actually quite hard work. Like, you're pretty much having to pump out a big essay every week and do a lot of reading around that. So it's not a walk in the park. So that's the basic training. And in addition to that, as a public health registrar, there's a few college training days that you undertake on the side outside of the university requirements. And then advanced training makes up the balance of the 4 years, so it's about 2.5 years, and you generally rotate through three different placements. The only compulsory one at the moment is a public health unit placement, and that can be done at pretty much any public health unit around the country. And the other two placements, or two to sometimes three placements that people do, there is some choice and flexibility involved, bearing in mind that it still has to be an accredited work site and that sort of thing. But there is the opportunity to choose some of the interests that might have taken you down a public health line. So for me, I did some environmental health work at Mass University, which has a Centre for Public Health Research. And I did mainly environmental health indicators for climate change in that placement. And then I did my last placement at the Health Quality and Safety Commission because I was quite interested in quality improvement as part of health systems. And then at the end of all of that and placements and various bits of coursework along the way, you have a final, like a part two exam, which is 100% oral. So it's only just about an hour or just over an hour long. And it's a summative assessment in that you can get asked pretty much anything across 8 questions. And the intent is to showcase a broad range of knowledge. And as with many part twos, it's playing the game in terms of how you're able to get that information across and the communication, and because it's 100% oral, the verbal communication around that becomes a really important part of what is ultimately a performance.
Mm. And this is the New Zealand College of Public Health Medicine, because I know that there are actually two ways you can train to become a public health specialist. And I'd love to hear if you know any of the differences between choosing to do it with the New Zealand College versus choosing to do it with the Royal Australasian College of Physicians.
I probably can't give you too many details about the Australasian College. So that we used to be the same overall college. Under the RACP umbrella, there's the Australasian Faculty of Public Health Medicine. And the New Zealand College used to be part of that, and it was all the AFPHM. And we became a separate college around about 12 years ago, I think. Because we began life as part of the AFPHM, the training programs are pretty similar, and there's been an attempt to keep them similar so that there is that, not reciprocity, but the ability to, I guess, make sure that your training scheme, or that our training scheme in New Zealand, is benchmarked against international ones. And so they are relatively similar. The New Zealand one is obviously necessarily quite focused on equity and Te Reti related competencies. And that's one of the main differences between the training programs. The others, I think, are probably more around funding and oversight, and I couldn't talk to the detail around them.
Yeah, that's fair enough. And I know that you've also worn a different hat as the council member of the New Zealand College of Public Health Medicine. What was the work that you did in this space, and does it have anything to do with knowing what they're looking for in potential applicants for public health medicine?
Yeah, so I've been on the council twice. The first time I was as chair of the registrar committee, so during my training years, and one of the council member positions is the registrar chair. And then the second time I was on, they have a new fellow position, or like a recent fellow. So I was on for a second stint in that role. Each time it's been as a general council member. So I guess the first time I had the registrar committee kind of portfolio. The second time there's not a specific portfolio that the new fellow takes, but I probably leaned a bit towards supporting the registrar training program, knowing that you know, what it was about, because I've recently finished it. I didn't get involved in any of the selection processes at the time, so that's often or generally done by the training program staff and the director of training within the college, which is not a council role.
That's fair enough. And now I know that you're clinical director of the Auckland Regional Public Health Service, and now you're moving into a different role. I'd love to hear about what you do currently as clinical director, what your day-to-day looks like, and then perhaps we could chat a little bit about what your next role is looking like.
I started at Auckland Regional Public Health in 2019 and have been clinical director there for about half of that time. In all honesty, much of the time since I've been clinical director has been COVID, and I guess the on-paper job description is part of the leadership or management team of the service. So it's myself and a director and a general manager that make up the kind of tight three at the leadership team. And the day-to-day is the professional responsibility and the clinical accountability across the whole service. So we've got, in peacetime, like pre-COVID times, we had around 130 FTE of staff, and we've pretty much doubled that through COVID. And we've more than doubled our doctors, and I've got the kind of the clinical portfolio across all of the outputs, if you like, or services. But that particular kind of professional accountability for medical teams. So there's around 35 odd FTE there at the moment. So it's been a real mix. There's the usual things you'd expect for the clinical director position, where you are talking about priorities and clinical safety and quality and sort of strategic direction and some professional issues that get raised to you, or concerns that are raised, probably more interaction with other services than what my colleagues at us have, just because if things come, you know, from other parts of the system, they tend to come to the clinical director. And that's the same for how COVID's rolled out. So a lot of my time during COVID was on external meetings rather than the internal response stuff. So I started off during COVID was not clinical director, and that my initial role was with a nurse colleague pretty much setting up very initial health response at the border. So before the borders closed, where we were only legally able to provide information because COVID wasn't a notifiable disease at that point, and then shifted it from there into some quite heavy response operation stuff. And then after that became clinical director. And so then it was a lot more external stuff, regional and national meetings on a daily basis, and seemingly never-ending meetings with that. So a lot of time on Zoom. Yeah,
that's fair. I'm going to dumb this down a little bit, because I remember when I did a little stint in ARFS, I really had no understanding of what public health was and what a public health doctor did. So I wonder if you could expand on what can someone expect a public health medicine specialist to be doing, even outside of your role, even just like any other public health medicine specialist, because they honestly do so many things, and that really surprised me.
Yeah, it's really hard to explain the breadth of it, and I think that's one of the challenges of public health is like, frankly, defining what we do. So I'll try and be really high level as well. I think the easiest way I've found to describe public health really is that rather than treating individual patients that have already got disease, we try and treat whole populations before any disease happens. So it's the two key differences are populations or communities rather than individuals, and then trying to be as upstream as we can. Across the population of public health physicians, there's some broad themes. There are about a quarter, or maybe just more than a quarter, that are medical officers of health, and we can go into what that means in a minute. So working at public health units and doing a lot of response stuff at a regional level. Around another kind of quarter or so in academic public health. There's some really prolific researchers and producers of new knowledge in New Zealand across several different disciplines. So that's everything from the kind of core epidemiology, stats-based, real heavy quantitative stuff through to some quite heavy policy work, a lot of work on Te Rere and equity and Māori health and Pacific health, and then some kind of core topic stuff. So we've got leading experts in public health and climate change and public health and tobacco or nutrition, smoke-free, that sort of thing. So there's a whole range of topic-based academia. And then there's another chunk, probably like maybe a fifth or so, that do more policy-based public health. So they might work in the ministry or now in kind of national parts of Te Whatu Ora Health New Zealand, doing a variety of different roles. It might be policy, might be interaction between different agencies. So there's the odd public health physician that works in a non-health ministry, such as had people working at MSD associated with Oranga Tamariki, or the ACC back in the days when we had Ministry of Agriculture and Fisheries. There was someone working at MAF. So quite varied responses in that kind of policy strategy government space. And then there's a handful that work as like private consultant type public health. So they might have niche interests in particular research or occupational health or environmental health, that sort of thing, and the interactions of those with public health. So that's the kind of the broad summary. Within those of us that work at public health units, best thing about it is the variety. Everyone now knows what goes on in a outbreak response, and a kind of having been published through the media with COVID since, but that is still just a quite a narrow range of what the health protection response can be. So we do everything from emergency preparedness sort of stuff on the before anything's even happened end of the scale, through to outbreak responses. We all know through COVID, but then even within outbreak responses, differing arrangements. So it might be heavily involved in the kind of epidemiology, demographics, pulling the data, intelligence space. There might be people that are really focused on strategy within a public health outbreak response. there's people that will direct traffic in terms of the operations. And so in the very early stages, yes, we were some of the ones interviewing COVID cases on the phone themselves, or calling people up and letting them know that their institution had been affected by some kind of COVID interaction. But as time went on, we were not doing that. We were sitting more up at the directing traffic end of outbreak responses. And then that's across 50 or so notifiable diseases that come through our ranks most days. And then a lot outside of health protection, in terms of the communicable disease control work, there's a lot of environmental health. So interacting with water, with port agencies, with airports around mosquito interceptions, that sort of thing. And then moving further away from disease control and environments, then we do a lot in non-communicable disease and policy. So huge amounts of work going on at the moment in tobacco and alcohol, with some legislative reviews that are either happening or in the process of starting to happen. And that real core policy advocacy is another reason that a lot of people get into public health. It's upstream determinant stuff and the links with poverty and education and housing and that sort of thing that really are core, and not just health promotion, but policy responses and that sort of thing that we can utilize as levers for promoting health.
Mm.
One thing I haven't touched on yet is all of the screening and immunisation work that goes on, that involves quite a few public health physicians around the country as well.
It's absolutely so broad, even listening to you trying to categorise what are the different aspects of what a public health medicine specialist can do. It's tricky. There's just so many tentacles that they have. I'd love to go back to what you said about the medical officer of health and just tell us a little bit about what that means and what that entails.
Within the subset of public health medicine specialists, those of us that work in public health units are often designated as medical officers of health. And what that means is that we've got special kind of permission, if you like, or delegated authority from the Director General of Health, usually, to undertake certain actions within the law in order to control the public health. And so if you happen to have a side hustle as a legal junkie and go through legislation.govt.nz, then there are a number of acts and regulations and that sort of thing that refer to medical officer of health roles. And the obvious one that everyone's now aware of is to do with health protection and the kind of infectious disease or communicable disease. And that means that if the need arises, we can require certain people or organisations to do or not do certain things. And the powers can be pretty broad sweeping at times because of the necessity at times to protect the public's health, but they are also not utilised on a daily basis. It's an instrument that's there, able to be used if the situation arises. And it's, I guess, the closest equivalent that people are more familiar with is the legislation under the Mental Health Act around sectioning people. That's under one act, and I guess the key differences within public health for medical officers of health are that involve a number of different acts and a number of different actions that can take place or that might be required for to happen.
Yeah.
And it's one of a suite of tools rather than a singular individual response.
And one of the things is that, for example, the Mental Health Act, physicians like us can activate it for patients. I'm just wondering, would you be able to give a specific example of an act that might be used in the setting of COVID, for example, which is a bit of a leading question because I know what you guys are capable of doing, but just for people who are listening who are unfamiliar with the powers that be with medical officers of health and what they can do within those acts. Because I know that you can, for example, section certain people with COVID, for example, if they're refusing to abide by isolation. That was very early on.
Yeah, so the main things that we did with COVID were to require people to stay in isolation, or sometimes we required them to go and get tested. They didn't need to be used very often for individuals because generally people were quite willing to do what was required of them to be good citizens, and that included going and get testing or staying home if they were sick. But every now and again, there was someone that really struggled to do that for various reasons. And we generally try really hard to not have to resort to those legal means. Often people don't do the easy thing because it's not the easy thing for them. So it might be really difficult to stay in isolation if you're the sole breadwinner for a family. And so one of the key things that made COVID work was that a lot of the social supports that are needed to be in place to allow someone to be in isolation were there. So there was income support available from that was really accessible compared to what we have for many other notifiable diseases. But every now and again, we did have to write specific directions to people to require them to either stay in isolation, stay in a MIQ if they weren't able to stay in their own home, or if that showed that they weren't compliant with staying where they were meant to be staying, or sometimes to go and seek to get them tested. But the reality is that we try and do everything else first before we get sorts of those sorts of measures.
Yeah, that's fair enough. And I know that many of the medical officers of health in there were reluctant to use those tools unless absolutely necessary. There was lots of trying to work with them and cooperate with groups of people and clients and patients before resorting to like draconian kind of rules. The other thing I wondered is, if you work in a public health unit, do you automatically become a medical officer of health? How does this happen?
Yeah, no, you don't automatically become one. So generally, if you're a public health physician, you know, vocationally registered working in a public health unit, then you will almost always be a medical officer of health, but it's a separate application process. You have to show that you've had the necessary experience and training, which is mostly done by the fact that you're a vocationally registered specialist, but also needing to have the confidence of your colleagues, of your peers. So there's a referee process involved in the application. And then that goes off to what is the Ministry of Health, and they do their end of the application and checking process for suitability. And then the actual kind of piece of paper itself is signed by the Director General. Because you're acting under his or her delegated authority.
It's really interesting hearing about all the different aspects of public health and all, how broad it is, because it's one of the things that we don't really get a lot of experience in, especially as resident medical officers. And I had a real privilege of being able to work in the Auckland Regional Public Health Service at the peak of the Delta outbreak. And so I was lucky enough to be able to get an insight into public health, but I know that it's not an opportunity that's broad enough across New Zealand for people to experience. So it's really interesting just being able to hear it, and I hope this is helpful so far. But the other thing I wanted to talk about is that I know that outside of work, family is a big part of your life as well. And I know that you had mentioned to me before previously that you had been a stay-at-home mum for about 5 years, and the transition back into medicine was quite difficult. I wonder if you could talk about this period of your life and when it was in your career and how you navigated the process.
So I didn't intend to be a stay-at-home mum for any particular length of time. I think when I was pregnant with my first baby, I indicated I'd have 6 months off and then go back part-time, which I think is possibly quite a standard intention. And then when she was born, firstly, I really enjoyed it. And secondly, I wasn't quite sure how I was going to handle going back to work, because my husband was also doing various specialist exams at that time, and so there was just quite a lot on, and we didn't have family support, etc. And we also wanted more than one child and relatively close together. So for us, we had this reprioritization where basically we just decided that my husband Chris would go hardcore through his two training programs and I'd be at home with babies. And so for year on year, we basically went, he had an exam, we had a baby, he had an exam, we had another baby, he had an exam, we had a third baby. And that was a really tough period because we didn't have as many resources available to support things as we do now in terms of family, income and options, basically. But it was the right decision for us in retrospect. So I ended up having 5 years off pretty much completely. I did a very small amount of contract work, and I was on the Medical Association board, which kind of just kept my mind ticking over the kind of systems issues that I wanted. And so I did that just after I finished the master's. So basically between basic and advanced training was my five-year gap. I would highly recommend it. I wasn't sure how it was going to work, and when I called the medical council at the end of that first 6 months period of maternity leave and said, how long can I have off? They said, oh, you can have as much time as you want. We've had people off for 1-2 years, and I was like, oh yeah, but I was thinking of several in a row without doing anything and not maintaining an annual practicing certificate. And at that point, which was a while ago now, they didn't have the same pathway for that as they do now, I don't think. So they were pretty much, it seemed like it was being designed as we went along in terms of my return to practice. But what made it easier for me was that I knew what specialty I was in, so I knew what the general route of continuing professional development would be. I kept in touch with the college training program, so even though I'd officially resigned my training post from the college perspective, I was still in touch with them, and so they knew that I was always intending to come back. And I did what I could, which is why I did that very small amount of contract work that was just at-home flexible stuff. And the board stuff was actually really helpful because at the time we wrote the NZMA equity position statement, which was called public health. So for anyone that's thinking about when's the right time to have children, the answer is that it's never a great time. It doesn't fit into the medical careers in one sense. But on the other hand, it means that it always fits in because you make it work, and it's a lot. There's a lot more structure in place to allow that, it's that sort of flexibility than there was 15 years ago. So I'd encourage people to do it. Just make sure that you have a vague plan. Like you have to know, stay on the right side of people, have a vague plan of when you might be coming back, and don't be afraid to say that to others because it helps them plan as much as it helps you plan.
Did you transition back into medicine like through like part-time and then return to work, or did you go from like nothing to full-time? Like, how did you navigate that transition back?
Yeah, so I did my advanced training all at Point Six, which was really helpful. It's one of the great things about public health is that it is a lot easier to do things part-time, and I'm very aware that's not the case for every training program. I pretty much started back when my youngest baby turned one and was at Point Six for the next several years. And there were some hoops I had to jump through from the medical council perspective for that transition. Like, I had to have a lot more forms filled in, basically. It was a bit like being a PGY1 again with the additional forms every couple of months. But that wasn't too bad in the context of being a registrar anyway. So I had forms anyway. It was just an extra form sort of thing.
Okay. It sounds like you navigated that transition pretty well, but it is certainly really anxiety inducing for a lot of female doctors who are trying to transition back into work. So it's a worthwhile topic to touch on. And the other thing that you mentioned just before is that both you and your partner, medical doctors in training, how did you navigate this part of your life of having a duo medical partnership and I guess pretty demanding training programs on both sides and trying to balance both of them out?
Yeah, I don't know that we've done it any better than what anyone else does. It was really hard. So my husband, Chris, he's an intensivist, but he's also trained as an anaesthetist. There was some crossover for his training programs in that he only had to do one part one. That did extend the length of his training. For us, it just worked having him focus on his training, and then I was able to focus on mine after that, at the point when he had a little bit more flexibility in terms of rostering and things, because I think by the time I went back, he was either a consultant or a fellow, like just about there sort of thing. What's the answer? I think the answer that worked for us, and it won't work for everyone, but for us, it was definitely around accepting that we had to outsource a lot. And I wonder how some people survive when there's not a lot of outsourcing happening. And it's not in my nature. I like to be able to do all sorts of things. So it doesn't sit that comfortably with me, but we've just worked out that we have to pay for things to make them happen. So that means we've had a nanny for 10 years or several different nannies in the 10-year period. We have a cleaner. We've paid for basically anything that we can. So down to handyman kind of jobs rather than spending half a day getting frustrated at trying to fix stuff at home. Gardening at times when that's gotten overwhelming. Yeah, just whatever works, and it's different things for different people, but yeah, whatever works to keep things functional basically on the home front means that you're not continually stressed with your kids because you're trying to parent them on your non-working days, but also run a household.
And it really highlights the privilege that we hold financially as doctors to even be able to outsource these things, to be able to take some of the things off our plate so that we have more of a cognitive capacity to deal with everything else in our lives and our training programs and our families and things we actually want to prioritize. And speaking of all of this, I'm wondering what you think of the work-life balance, and what is work-life balance to you?
Yeah, just on the finances. So I think it's really important to note that when I first started back at work, basically everything I was earning went into our nanny. And we I don't even think we had a cleaner at that point. And it was pretty much like I got about $20 in my pocket at the end of those weeks. And that's just how it was. But we knew that it wasn't going to stay like that. And we are lucky and we are privileged. And I'm not trying to deny that. But we also decided that it wasn't, we were going to have to make those decisions for the first few years. And it's fine now. The kids are a lot older and we no longer have to do the lawns on the weekends because they do. Like that's the word, like balance, aren't you?
Delegate down.
Yeah, I'm not breaking the work life balance because I really enjoy my job at the moment. And I guess that's good in a way that even though it has been all consuming at times, particularly over COVID, I get a lot of joy out of it. And I think that has also surprised me. I thought I was really maternal and would never work full time when the kids were still living at home. But I've realized that I really enjoy working and I would be a complete workaholic if I didn't have children to make me come home at night.
They balance you out.
Yeah.
Keep you on an even keel.
Yeah. They do, yeah. And I think exercise is really important for me as well. I'm not at all an exercise freak, but I know I need to do it for me to be able to function and living quite a busy life. And I think that's been something else I've learned really is over the last 10 years is if I'm not at a point where I'm exercising somehow. So at the moment I bike to work and that's most of my exercise. And at previous times I've been more into trail running in Wellington, which I still miss. But for me, it just means that I can fit everything else in weirdly.
Yeah. I know you say that you don't have a work-life balance or it's hard for you to achieve, but I have to say that as a whole, the Auckland Regional Public Health Service is one of the best places I worked at in terms of the culture of that workplace encouraging work-life balance. And I think that kind of thing comes from the leadership as well. So I think that speaks to your leadership as clinical director because it really disseminated down. I remember people really encouraging us to leave on time, really encouraging us to actually take our days off properly, especially when we were kind of pod rostering during COVID. Don't attend meetings on Monday if that's your roster day off. Even if you are a crucial member of the team, it doesn't matter. It's not crucial enough to compromise your well-being. And those were some comments that I heard really only exclusively in the Auckland Regional Public Health Service. I've never again worked in a department that encouraged our well-being that way. And I remember in the early days when we did have yoga or Pilates classes, some of the medical officers would come to the RMO's office and be like, oh, you should come and come join us and be part of it together. And I really appreciated that, even though I know you speak that you don't have a work-life balance, but I really think your leadership has disseminated down through the whole department to show that a lot of people really value work-life balance there. The culture was really healthy.
Well, I'm really pleased to hear that, but I have to say the sad truth is that we learned from our mistakes. And measles and in the first year of COVID, we didn't do that well. And so what you saw was we learned from that, and which is great to see that learning is coming through.
Yeah, yeah.
And we have worked really hard, and at times it's felt quite hollow when we were trying desperately to think of what we could do for work-life balance when the whole of Auckland was at level 3 and you could tell people would have the day off, but all they can do is go, I'd stay home, you'd go to the supermarket with a mask on because everything else was closed. It did feel quite hollow and we had to think outside the square quite a lot to remind people what their options were for work-life balance and to bring what we could in-house. So I'm pleased to hear that's coming through.
It was awesome. I wasn't there for the first few, but it's a real testament to the department and the leadership that things changed, because I see hospitals repeat mistakes over and over again despite having made errors before and make absolutely no difference the next time round. And it just gets into the too hard basket. So I really appreciate it as somebody who's junior to be able to see the senior ranks actually want to do something about it.
Amazing staff come in and they're still there and they've really made a big difference. Teams like our Pacifica team, they were so fantastic at pumping the loud music during level 3, going outside and doing some
exercises together.
The things like that were really fantastic in making a difference. And I think it became family because we were there so many hours that you really did see. My family was away for the month, like my kids got and my dog sent away for the month during Delta, the first month of Delta, because we knew that we were both going to be a bit slammed. So that was hard to not have at home, but it did make coming to work a little bit easier knowing that at least some stuff was going to be thought through. So,
yeah, absolutely. I want to say thank you very much for taking your time out. I really appreciate your time. So thank you very much for coming on board, Maria.
Thanks, Mansell. Great to see you again, and really good work with the podcast.
This podcast was made possible by the New Zealand Doctors Residents Association Education Trust. Thank you for listening. Mā te wā.